Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Sports Weekender here on Planet FM. Well, it was a rather cold start to the morning here in the 09, and of course, I hope everyone enjoyed Matariki. And of course, yesterday was my mum's 80th birthday, so happy birthday, mum. Be travelling down to Christchurch just to catch up with the family, bit of a family dinner, then watch the big game later on. So, yeah. Anyway, just before we get to our next guest, which is Brian Ashby, a big shout out to Father Ted's Original Irish Pub. They have a selection of local craft and international draft beers on tap. They have a selection of bottled beers, fine wines, good spirits, and music Wednesday night through to Saturday night, some great food. They're located at 1 Wellesley Street West, opposite the iconic Civic Theatre. Their number is 09-377-3142, or you can email them fatherteds@hotmail.com. Well, I have to say, we come to the grand final. The grand final we all expected in Super Rugby. And our next guest, he's a legendary broadcaster, commentator, superb. You know, been the voice of Crusaders Rugby for many, many years. And not only that, you probably would have heard his voice many times on the radio covering Olympics and Commonwealth Games. Please, it's my pleasure to welcome Brian Ashby from Christchurch. Good morning, Brian.
Yeah, morning, Eamon. It's pretty exciting, isn't it? Match day. Is it the final that everyone would have picked at the start of the year? I think everyone would have picked the Chiefs, probably the Blues. Based on last year, I'm not so sure.
Well, it's a big game in many ways. Just before we get to the breaking down of the squads, because it's for the Chiefs, it's goodbye to Clayton McMillan, who I think's been fantastic. It's goodbye to Apollo Project Stadiums, which I don't think anyone's really going to miss. and we've spoken about this again, and of course we're not allowing any cowbells. Well, there's been a bit of banter going on between the two cities, all Hamilton and Christchurch. So, it all adds to the spice of what should be a brilliant final. And looking at these squads, and of course, big news coming in was Tamaiti Williams will be playing this final, Brian.
I think George Bauer is a very good player to bring off the bench and makes great impact later in a game, but as a starter, not so much. You do lose a bit, as well as he has played in recent weeks. But Tamaiti Williams has just gotten better and better, hasn't he? Week in, week out, through the campaign, through the last couple of years. He came in as a special project under Jason Ryan. I think his rugby intelligence, as much as it, aside from his sheer brute strength, he came in as 165 kilos when he first came under the first class scene, and I've pulled him back to under 140, and he's still an absolute man mountain. I just used to refer to him in commentary as the fridge whenever he got on the ball. And he will make a difference, and that's important because the Chiefs pack is big, burly, abrasive, extremely physical. They attack sort of slightly, their clean outs a little wider than some teams. Having a presence, somebody as big as Tamaiti Williams is hugely important to the Crusaders to try and counter what we know this magnificent Chiefs side is going to bring.
Yeah, and because we look at those front rows, and they're both, you have a look at them. You look at the Crusaders, Tamaiti Williams, obviously Corey Taylor, who's, one of, if not the best hooker in the world. And then we look at Fletcher Newell, who's really had a great season. Taki Aho, Ollie Norris, could be knocking on All Blacks' doors. Second row, we have, obviously, Scooter Barrett and Saffron will be the locks there. Tupu Vai, but Arcoy, very much a threat. But the loose forward trios, they've both got probably the best, many would say, taken out Artie Sevier, maybe Duplessis, Kariffi and Peter Lackey, probably the best loose forward trios between the two teams.
Yeah, I think in recent weeks, the Crusaders have settled back in with Christie on the open side. They started the season sort of either having him on the bench or not in the match day squad at all. And this is a bloke who's, topped the tackle count in the competition for quite a few years now. And they sort of preferred Blackadder on the open side and Cullen Grace on the blind. And I think as time's gone on, I think Blackadder, last week I think were 29 tackles or something in that semi-final. Mm. And he's good. He's a good guy to finish a game, perhaps, on the open side. But to me, he's a number six and a very, very good number six. You know, if you can keep the guy not broken, he's tremendous. Leo Willey's been wonderful, but you know, for the Chiefs, how good is Luke Jacobson? What a great leader he is. He's a guy that looks like somebody who could captain an All Black team to me. I wonderful player. You mentioned the second rows there, and I think the key player in many ways is a key player on both sides. For me, for the Crusaders, it's Scott Barrett. He's been at 95% through this campaign. He needs to be at 100 tonight, and he will. He's a big game player. I don't know whether there's a little bit of rugby burnout going on there, but he will rise. And I think that's the key. They need a massive game from Scott Barrett tonight against a very, very good Chiefs second row. Shell Foon's been the quiet achiever.
Yeah, very good. And when you look at the halfback first five combinations, obviously we know the McKenzie Ratimar combinations, All Black combinations. You know, Ratimar has had a slow start. To me, I've actually been impressed more with Xavier Rowe's play, to be honest with you, Brian. But then we look at the Crusader of Hopham and Rivers Rahana. Now, that's a guy that probably was number three on the first five list at the beginning of the season, Kamara's injury, and he's really slotted into that role well, Brian. He has gained confidence. He looks assured. You know, he looks like a guy that's willing to give it a go.
Well, you know, and that's one of the key things, I think, in the Crusaders' turnaround this year. You know, they were poor last year. There has never been, other than 1996, a worse Crusaders set of men playing in the number 10 jersey. They really did struggle. Kamara and Rahana really lacked confidence. Burke obviously was, they had injury issues and so on there as well. And just seeing the confidence in those young guys, maybe the input from Brad Moore coming in the coaching mix, a former first five himself, but perhaps that's been part of the turnaround, the experience of James O'Connor in the mix. But I mentioned the two key players, the other key player in the match tonight, Barrett for the Crusaders, D-Mac for the Chiefs, and I think despite how long he has been around, I think this year we have seen a maturing in his game in terms of we know what a great attacking player he is, but he's actually steered his team around the park effectively, and I think that's been a real weakness in his game. Strategically, he hasn't always gotten that right. Same for Beauden Barrett. I thought, you know, Beauden Barrett in that quarter final against the Chiefs probably played the best game I've seen him play in years. He played with great maturity. His kicking game around the park was just magnificent. And I was sort of left thinking, where's this game been? You know, where's it been all this time? It's there, and so that I thought that was a real plus we've seen from both Barrett and D-Mac this year, because I was sort of like, yeah, are we going to have to go through another season of these guys in the black jersey? Maybe it's time for Reuben Love to, you know, get the look in there. But D-Mac tonight, if he can continue playing the way he has for the Chiefs and steer them around what's going to be a greasy old park tonight. It's a cold day in Christchurch. I don't think we're getting over 10 degrees, and it's going to be 4 or 5 degrees during the match. So it's going to be, you know, it's going to be very cold. You're on a field that is slightly narrower than regulation. So, you know, that's something else. You know, kickers, often they just put them out on the floor and people go, oh, what a clown that guy. But they're judging it on a regular size field. This field is actually slightly undersized, so in terms of its width. So that's something else that has to be taken into account.
Absolutely, and of course then we look at the midfield. Obviously you've got Havili, and you look at Tapia probably trying to put his hands up for an All Black recall. Back three, we all know what Will Jordan can do, just brilliant. Sevu Reece likely to be named in the All Black squad. Maka Stringer has had an excellent season. I look at the back three of the Chiefs, and obviously Narua, and of course Leroy Carter, who we'll be talking about a bit later. But Sean Stevenson, really, he's probably got something to, probably wants to leave this game with something to prove to people.
Yeah, one of the, you know, look, I mean, he's barely had a look at All Black level, hasn't he? One test, I think, and didn't go particularly well for him. One of those great players in Super Rugby who, he's made a real impact for the Chiefs over a long period of time. And finishing his career with a title, stalwart in a Chiefs team that's played plenty of finals under Clayton McMillan, and it would be a great way for him to go out. But yeah, in some ways, the back row, they sort of cancel each other out, don't they, in terms of the quality of the names there. And it's so good seeing Quinn Tupaia on top of his game, you know, after everything he's been through. I think, you know, and as you say, we'll talk about it in a wee bit, but I think that there are a number of guys who could start at number 12 for the All Blacks and be very good long-term players in that jersey. And Quinn Tupaia is one of those guys, an immensely talented, intelligent rugby player.
And, of course, we finish off and look at the bench. And, of course, James O'Connor, I think he's been... I think this has been the buy of the season for Super Rugby. He came to the Crusaders, a lot of criticism on there, a lot of criticism on Rob Penny for picking him. But you know what? He's proven his worth.
Well, you know, experience. Everyone climbed into Rob Penny enormously. And it's a soft target. You only need to look at sort of the things that went wrong in terms of broken bodies and the like last year. And suddenly you analyse it. You see games where, you know, one player who's playing tonight's final couldn't count down the clock. All he had to do was wind the clock down to shot a goal and they would have had a win. They ended up losing the game, you know, in the last second. So all those things, people love to climb in to Rob Penny and they say, oh, he's done nothing as a coach. He's won 4 NPC titles. He got Coach of the Year in Ireland. All these, you know, he's had a really good career. People just love to fire shots. So when James O'Connor came on board, it was like, yeah, I get this. But, you know, as I say, people love to fire shots. It's been great. He's been his input around those huge guys. I'm sure later in the careers, you know, in 5 or 10 years from now, Ray Hanna and Kamara will mention in interviews the influence that O'Connor had on their game and on their games and the growth of their games. I think the only disappointment for O'Connor, A, he didn't get to start more because everyone wants to start, and B, he hasn't been selected in the Wallaby squad for the Lions series, which, you know, how good is he off the bench? And that test level, that would have been, I would have thought, quite an innovative selection. It could have worked quite well for the Wallabies.
Okay, yep, absolutely. Okay, we'll just move on quickly. And All Blacks squad gets named on Monday at the Coastal Rugby Club. Now, anyone thinking that Scott Barrett's not going to be, is going to be dropped as captain of the Coastal Rugby Club, I think there's more of a chance of someone else getting dropped, but we won't go into there. I look at this All Blacks squad and I know Razor Robinson is quite conservative in his selections, but I look at the possible newbies, Fabian Holland from the Highlanders, Duplessis Corriffy. You also look at the backline, Tavatava Naiwai, Leroy Carter, Caleb Tangatau, and even Josh Fisher-Tua from the Blues, probably an outside shout.
Yeah, maybe. The one that I would most like to see there is Tavatava Naiwai from the Highlanders. I think he's been amazing. And, you know, a lot of people, it's easy to look good when you're in a side that's going well with a pack in front of you that's you know, got good go forward ball. He hasn't always had that with the Highlanders, has he? And I think he's been absolutely superb. And he does have the advantage of also being able to play out on the wing as well. So he might be a good guy that they would look at saying, well, you know, he could make a real impact late in the game if we brought him off the bench and he's covering a few positions. So I hope that he gets a look. And that's probably the one that I'm most looking forward to. The midfield, I love midfield, and I don't think you can go wrong in terms of who you select at 12. It's who you leave out. Jordy Barrett is going to be there, no two ways about it. So is Tavatava Naiwai in there? Is David Havili in there? Is Quinn Tupaia in there? All of these are excellent options in the number 12 jersey, but you go out one position to number 13, and, you know, the enigma that is Rico Ioane, do you stick with him? He hasn't had a good campaign. He hasn't always been that great for the All Blacks in recent years. Do they stick with him? And I think that's the big question. My gut feeling is they will, but I would hope that if the other guy that they see is in the number 13 jersey is Billy Proctor, he would be my starting option. I think he's been superb. Maybe, you know, maybe we get the likes of Rona. Braden Enor's been superb in combination at the Crusaders. The midfield for me is the most interesting aspect of this All Black team that's being named.
Absolutely. Well, Brian, I hope you enjoy the match, and I hope where you're watching it, you'll obviously be watching it at home, because I don't think too many people, I think everyone's waiting for Te Kaha to open.
No one's going to miss the pile of scaffolding, but you know, we've got an NPC campaign to get through on it yet on the old rusty old Ratley.
I have to say, and this is, I looked at the NPC schedule for Canterbury, and I know they've probably got contractual obligation with the stadium, but God, wouldn't it have been a difference to take a few day matches at, instead of taking one at Tarangiora, maybe another one? And maybe, due to the fact that NPC has smaller crowds, why not go back to the old rugby park in Mirabelle?
It worked well after the earthquakes, there's no doubt about that, and the size of it did create a very good atmosphere. No two ways about that. It's not the worst sort of option, potentially, but as you say, there probably are contractual obligations, and they also live in hope of getting bigger numbers into these games as well. And you know, you can't at Rugby Park, you are sort of limited in terms of size. So, you know, at the moment they're sort of getting probably, 3,000-5,000 at the NPC games. If they could get sort of 7 or 8, 9, they'd probably be happy. But therein lies the challenge for the marketers.
Well, that's it. And of course, you know, free to air, of course, with the NPC, it's going to be a whole different story in a few years' time with TV rights, etc. Anyway, Brian, I hope you enjoy the weekend. Who are you packing just before we close off, Crusaders?
My heart says that. Common sense says Chiefs, doesn't it? Because they've absolutely pantsed them. But 2 years ago, everything said the Chiefs, the Crusaders did it. Blues under Leon McDonald, everything said the Blues, Crusaders did it. Finals footy is very weird. Crusaders at home. Probably the Chiefs, but I'm sticking with the Crusaders.
You know what? I'm with you. I'm actually going to go for the Chiefs in this one. I'm going to be very popular when I get on my flight down to Christchurch today, aren't I? But I'll keep that quiet.
All the evidence says that's a cold hard fact,
It is. And if anyone's that could beat that record, I believe they're the only team that could do it. Anyway, Brian, you have a fantastic weekend, and hopefully we'll catch up soon.
Happy birthday to your mum.
Hey, thanks a lot, Brian. Cheers, mate. Bye. Brian Ashby, great guy, isn't he? Anyway, next up we're going to do our regional club review with Stephen Harris. Welcome everyone back to the sports review, sports weekend, the sports review. God, that was the old show back many, many moons ago. Anyway, a big shout out to Force Electrical. At Force Electrical, they are a team of experienced professionals dedicated to provide high quality electrical services for both residential and commercial clients. With over 10 years of experience, they pride themselves and being reliable and thorough, and take care in ensuring that their clients' needs are met in a timely and efficient manner. So, if you're looking for any electrical work, give Force Electrical a call. Their number is 021-628-341. Or for any inquiries, nick@forceelectrical.co.nz. Okay, so we move on to the regional club rugby wrap, and here to join us, as he joins us every Saturday, and he's, we've found him a shovel. So this week, you know, don't dig yourself a hole, Stephen. That's my job.
No, I'll try not to. Hey, just as well you've invited me back to the show, always a privilege.
You're on someone else's network, bigger, probably earns more money, and probably 100% better broadcaster. And even I can admit that. I know my frailties. You know, I know my limits. Sometimes I do. Anyway, hey, we'll just kick it off. So we're going up to Whangarei, a bit of Northern rugby. And of course, one game has already been decided. Nga Te Hine Moriwa United won by default against Hora Hora. So we have three games in the Whangarei competition. Mid-Northern versus Old Boys Marist. Kamo versus Kerry Kerry. Hikarangi versus Western Sharks.
Yeah, possibly the game of the round. Mid-Northern versus OBM. Listen, sad to also hear about Hora Hora yesterday defaulting. Last week, they got an almighty hiding against Mid-Northern last weekend. I think that was pretty much the beginning of the end. They're struggling with a lot of injury and unavailability, so thoughts go out to those guys at Hora Hora. Hopefully they can scrape together a team for the last round. But just back on track for today, Mid-Northern, OBM. Mid-Northern playing at home. OBM, a very much improved side with a few lads putting their hands up for Northern Miners, but I think the Mid-Northern will be far too strong at home. Kamo take on Kerikeri. This is going to be a very interesting game because both of these sides are both sitting outside the top four, and they might be probably Kerikeri more of a chance if a few results go their way. So, but I'm probably going to go for the home side, Kamo. Kamo today, I think they'd probably want to try and finish the season strongly. And Hikarangi taking on Western Sharks today. Well, Hikarangi, they've struggled all season. They've just had the one draw, and Western Sharks are sitting in third placing on the table. They'll be pushing to try and get that second placing, to try and cement themselves in the second placing with just a round to go.
Absolutely, and then we just move on to North Harbour Rugby, and it's Jesus, there are already a couple of games and a bit of an upset in one of them, but we might as well get to it right now. So the games that were played, North Shore 47, ECB, East Coast Base 12, no real surprise there. This one, Northcote versus Maharangi, Northcote 21, Maharangi 22. I didn't see that coming, did you?
No, and to be brutally honest, if we were picking that result, we probably would have gone in the favour of Northcote. I know Northcote have got a few injuries at the moment, but that was a home game for them, and Mahurangi kicked a penalty in the very last play of the game to take the win. So congratulations to Mahurangi. There's a great little community up there. So big win for them. For Northcote, though, interestingly enough, I would have probably thought they were pretty much a shoo-in for top four, but boy, how important does that last game of the round against East Coast Base
become? Well, yeah.
Northcote yes. sitting on 43 points in fourth place, East Coast Base sitting on 40 points in fifth place, so that becomes doubly important. But however, like you say, it's pretty much a split round Friday, Saturday. We've got Kumu playing Silverdale today.
Well, I think you'd probably go for Silverdale on that one. And then, of course, this other one, I think it's a big one as well, too. Takapuna versus Massey.
Yeah, you know, I've gone across to watch Kelston Boys play St. Peter's today, but boy, that would have been a good destination to head across the bridge and watch that game. But, you know, Takapuna, they've got a few of the Moana boys back playing for them at the moment, and a couple of Tiki Lelinga, who's their centre midfielder, probably a guy who
from what I believe, not just North Harbour are looking at, but maybe even the Melbourne Storm are looking at as well, a midfield back. So very, and we all know what a good team Messi sitting in third placing, Takapuna sitting in second placing. That should be quite the battle, but I think I'll go with the home side, Takapuna.
Yeah, I think you probably would have to go for Takapuna on this one. Anyway, we'll just go to Auckland Women's, a game that was, and I'm just trying to get to the, in the bottom four, there's only one game, Silverdale versus Patamahoe. Now, to me, I think Patamahoe will take this one.
Yeah, bit of a drive for Patamahoe, but mate, we don't want the Brad Pitt of South Auckland stalking us, mate. So we'll go.
Well, yeah, well, the Brad Pitt, I try to get hold of him. He's not taking my calls, you know. Hey, Budgie, if you're listening, I hope you had a great day off yesterday, and I hope Patamahoe, and I hope you had enjoying your weekend off, and good luck to the Tuataras. But then we go to the top four, and there's some interesting matches here. Marist versus College Rifles, and that's over at Mount Wellington Domain. Manurewa versus Ponce. Now, these two games, this top four, that are Marist Rifle games. You know, Marist, you know, they got a bit of a toweling from, they got a little bit of a, well, they defaulted against Ponsonby, and of course, Rifles, a loss against Manurewa. Your thoughts?
Mm. Boy, I'm almost tempted to chicken out and just take the home teams today, but I'm going to go Marist to beat College Rifles, and I'm going to go Ponsonby to get the away win over
Manurewa. Absolutely dead on there, Steve. And then we go to Auckland Men's, and yesterday the game played Pakuranga, who basically the sun didn't shine on Bell Park last Saturday because they moved over to Gribblehurst Park. A great win by Eden, by the way. Pakuranga 28, Varsity 17. Now, this top six, to get into this top six, it is really a dogfight at the moment, as we all know. But these are some of the matches which I think that will go to form, and then we'll have our two teams to last, and I'll be making a few big statements, getting myself in trouble. Ponsonby versus Papatoe, Suburbs versus Marist. Well, that Ponsonby versus Papatoe game, you know, Ponsonby, you just wonder by how much in this one, Stephen.
Oh, very, very much so. Listen, can we go to the two easiest games to pick? I think Ponsonby will be far too strong for Papatoetoe. That'll be probably a good opportunity for Ponsonby to rotate their squad. And I think College Rifles playing Waitemata at home will be once again far too strong. Unfortunately,
well, I'm worried about this. I'm praying for all the people out west. You know, I went to Good Shepherd. I even prayed for Waitemata.
Yeah, I don't think for Waitemata this is going to be a week-by-week pick. So I think they need to start putting some plans in place for next year, because, to be honest, they were very disappointing against University. I know talking to Fritter or Jason McLean, the University coach, he said he never in his wildest dreams, he doesn't have that many wins over Waitemata, but certainly not by 660 points. So it's definitely a struggle for 60 Swanson Road, and I don't think the pain's going to go away anytime soon.
Suburbs Marist, you'd probably go Marist on this one with of Moana players back for them.
Oh, 100%. Although Suburbs, man, they started like a bat out of hell against Ponsonby last week, but obviously just ran out of puff. We know what a quality side Ponsonby are, and too strong. And I think Marist, with some of their guns that they've got available for them today, I think they'll be too strong.
Okay, so then we go to the final game, my club Eden. It's Eden versus Grammar Tech. Now, if anyone's seen the movie 300, it's one small army versus a big army. So it's one club versus 1,500 clubs in there. So I've probably lost some friends at Grammar Tech. Yeah. Eden really do need to, you know, win this game. And it's a special day for a couple of people. Olivia Roux. and Desmar Liana, Olivia Roux, what a legend. Frenchie, as I know him, a great guy and a good mate of mine. And he plays 150 games for this club. He is coming close to 40, but I can tell you what, he doesn't look 40 and he's probably the best defensive centre in Auckland rugby.
And he keeps telling me he's retiring every year. Every time I've spoken to him, he said, oh, yeah, I think it might have been a couple of years ago. He said, oh, no, I'm retiring. And I remember talking to him a year later, oh, I'm retiring, buddy.
He's such a wonderful bloke, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a fantastic bloke. And speaking of wonderful blokes, Desma, wow, you could not get a better guy. Yeah, he's the sort of guy that I reckon if he went and played club rugby somewhere else, he would have racked up some provincial games, whether it be for another province.
Because he came very close with Kenneth Manukau. He also played for Auckland as well too. Yeah, people tend to forget that.
Yeah, very very skillful footballer, can pretty much slot into most positions in the back line. Just as accomplished at halfback, as a more than handy goal kicker. But you don't need one when you've got the Costa brothers running the ship back at this Eden side. Listen, it's just great to see the boys, these two Argentinian boys, back at the club. That really, at the end of the day, is their club. You know, I know Nicholas bounced across to Manukau a few seasons back and picked up a title there. But that's not a bad record to have, eh? That you can pick up a...
Their home's Eden, Stephen. I can tell you this right now. Their home is Eden. It always has been, always will be, and you know what, I look at the side, you know, if you'd have said it weeks ago, you know, I'm picking Eden, because even though I'll be in Christchurch, because phones are great things, well, they can be, there can be pains in the backside, I'll get an alert that the sun has shone on Gribblehurst Park.
Mate, I'm probably gonna agree with you, man. Simply because I think these guys are just emotionally have got so much to play for. Grammar Tech's not a bad side, though. Let's not write them off. I know you're basically putting them up there as the favourites, but I don't think anybody can take this Eden side for granted. I mean, to say they've come a long way from the side that I actually saw lose to Waitemata at the beginning of the season, and I think just maybe having somebody like Joseph Tupe at number eight,
big difference.
Gives them real good go forward, and it's not a bad loose trio with the CLC Maiupo and also Rupini Masayako as well.
Yeah,
so that's a pretty handy loose forward trio.
Absolutely. Well, no Canning's Manukau rugby today, Stephen, so we won't get in trouble for calling the games early. I went to write it down, then I looked, oh shit, it's the 28th. Oh, I shouldn't have said that word. Anyway, hey, what was you? Did you have a quick look at that Lions Argentina game?
Yes, I did. I didn't see it in its entirety, but I did watch the second half. Now, listen, at the end of the day, I still expected the British and Irish Lions to be too strong for Argentina. Argentina, with a few players missing, still part of the French top 14 over these next 2 weekends. British and Lions Islands not at full strength, but playing in front of a full house in Dublin. It was the British and Irish Lions who got, the Argentinians. We got the job done 28-24 after they led by 21 points to 10 in the second half. Listen, the British and Lions Islands, Irish Lions just looked a bit scratchy. Combinations looked a bit scratchy, but they created a lot of opportunities. But that last pass just couldn't find the right man. Where Argentina didn't have a lot of chances, but just took their chances on offer, and none better than the Obinos try that was scored on the 60th minute, and that was started by Cordero. The first five, if you see the try, it's just typical Argentina, but they will be absolutely wrapped. I think that might be their first ever scalp over the British and Irish Lions, so there'll be a lot of celebrating back in Argentina this morning with that particular victory. As for the Lions, listen, you can see the potential of the side. Created a lot of opportunities, but probably not the way that they wanted to start. But I would not write them off, because as we know, British and Irish Lions teams get better when they tour.
Absolutely. Well, we'll call it there, Stephen. Have a great weekend. I'm down to Christchurch for I'm down at Christchurch for my mother's 80th birthday. Well, I shouldn't say that. I'll catch up with you next week.
Awesome. And are you heading along to Addington tonight?
No. Get that.
Centres for Business Owners.
Oh, sorry. No, I just don't even go there, mate. I can't wait to the car. I'll be there at Takaha. Don't you worry about that. So anyway, okay, you have awesome. A great day, mate. Cheers.
Good on you, buddy.
Cheers.
Take care.
Bye. Okay, that was Stephen Harris. I'm pressing all the wrong buttons today, aren't I? Anyway, next up, we'll go and talk some rugby league with Joey Green. Okay, I hope you can hear me. Just check. Joey, can you hear me?
Yep, got you, mate.
Yeah, just give me a second. Somebody, we've had a bit of an incident in here, so I'm going to have to swap mics. Okay, can you still... Okay, I'm going to have to go to another mic. Cheers. Okay, everyone, I hope you can hear me on this. Can you hear me loud and clear, Joey?
Gotcha, mate.
And I hope everyone can listen to me. Unfortunately, the main headset has basically got tangled up. So, yeah, just give me a second. I'll just see what microphone this one is. Let's see if it's in. Okay. Okay, I'll just see if anyone is hearing me. You continue away. Warriors versus Panthers, Joey.
Yeah, look, very interesting way I think this game's going to play out tonight. Warriors take it on the Panthers. Warriors, despite missing Kirk Capel and Mitchell Barnett, it's still a very handy side. Moala Graham-Telfer gets his first opportunity of the year as well. He's been very consistent in reserve grade, so great to see him get an opportunity tonight as well. But looking at this Penrith Panthers side, it's going to be an interesting matchup. Whilst I still think the Warriors should win quite comfortably, you never really know what you're going to get from a depleted Penrith side. They haven't been too red hot in New South Wales Cup, and it probably doesn't help that they've had a lot of injuries in first grade as well. But you just never quite know what you're going to get with a lot of these Penrith young fellas. So I'm interested to see how they go tonight, but I'm still expecting to see the Warriors win quite comfortably. And I think it'll come off the back of their back five. You've got, obviously, like I touched on, Moala Graham-Telfer getting his first opportunity. But then you've still got your experience in Nicol Klukstar and Roger Tuivasa-Sheck, who have basically been carrying a lot of the load in their back five this year, as well as Metcalf and Chanel Harris-Davidi, obviously. So a very classy Warriors side on paper, and I'm still expecting them to win quite heavily this afternoon.
Can you still hear me on here, Joey?
Yep, can still hear you, mate.
Okay, so listen, we're having some problems here with the mics here. Somebody, the mic is just, our headsets have just disconnected, and, you know, hopefully, if Michelle, if you're listening, can you come in here and help me out with this one? Basically, what I can see here is that, I think it will be a... It will be an absolutely different match compared to what we've seen in the past. I think the Warriors get up in this one.
Yeah, quite heavily as well. Like, I suppose when everyone would have looked at this game at the start of the season, you know, they would have been expecting to see, I guess, a full-strength Penrith side. But then you lose the likes of Cleary, Isaiah Yeo, Brian Tor, Dylan Edwards. You know, those are four heavy losses for a Penrith side who are basically running out their reserve grade backline this afternoon. And whilst they've still got a bit of punch up front with Moses Leota, Lindsay Smith and Isaiah Papali'i as well as the ever consistent Scott Torrenson, I think it's just going to be too tough a task for Penrith to try and get the 2 points this afternoon as well. So going to be a tough matchup for Ivan Cleary and his boys from Western Sydney, but I think the Warriors should come out firing, especially with how they've played the last couple of weeks as well.
Okay, thanks a lot. Anyway, Just anyone that is listening, if you're not hearing me, we'll just go through Raiders 16, Tigers 12. If you can just go through the games of the NRL for the weekend.
Yeah, last night Canberra taking on the Tigers was a very tough game for Canberra. They got up to an early 16-0 lead and they kind of thought they had the game wound up. But then, you know, the class of Jerome Luai nearly got them home. And it ended up being a 16-12 full-time score. But credit to for Canberra for, you know, a very tough effort, you know, managing to hold on in that second half and get the job done. The later games following the Warriors games tonight, the Dolphins taking on the Newcastle Knights. And when we take a look at this game from round two, the Knights won pretty comfortably, 26 points to 12. But when you take a look at recent form, as well as how the rest of the results have gone for both sides since that week, the Dolphins seem to be the hot side at the moment, and I think they're going to win quite comfortably tonight. I'm assuming it's going to be off the back of the likes of Isaiah Katoa and Kadi Nikarima. Lots of conversations going around Isaiah Katoa, and if Nathan Cleary isn't fit come Origin 3, Isaiah Katoa might be the guy to go to if it's not him or Luke Metcalf. So very interesting conversations to be had there, but I think the Dolphins are going to win pretty comfortably tonight. South Sydney Rabbitohs taking on the Melbourne Storm. Going to be an interesting matchup for the Bunnies. They don't have Cody Walker tonight, but they do welcome back Keon Kalomatangi from a fractured eye socket. So very quick recovery from him, and I think that's a massive inclusion for the Rabbitohs. But for Melbourne, who are obviously one of the hot sides at the moment, we're going to need to see a big effort from Stefano Utoikamanu. Didn't quite miss them or make the mark in Origin on Wednesday night. Had a very short stint and didn't quite manage to get through what he needed to. So lots of chat around him possibly not being around in Origin Game 3. And I think over the next couple of weeks, he's going to need to see some big efforts. And then we take a look at Sunday afternoon, three matchups on Sunday afternoon, and the first one at 4 o'clock, we take a look at the Brisbane Broncos taking on the Cronulla Sharks. And I think for both of these sides, they're kind of in similar predicaments at the moment, in being that on their day, they can very well consider themselves premiership threats. But then, like we saw with Cronulla taking on the Warriors a couple of weeks ago, then they can kind of get blown off the park. And if we see anything from Brisbane, like how they played against the Titans a couple of weeks ago, then, you know, very well could be a heavy Broncos win. You could almost say the same for the Sharks as well. So this one's going to be very tight to call, but I'm going to think the Broncos will just be too strong at home. Then we take a look at the Roosters taking on the Cowboys at 6:05. The Roosters struggling a little bit last week to get the 2 points, missing a chunk of their Origin stars as well as their star halfback in Sam Walker. But we've seen that they're still a very good side. And on paper, you look at a lot of their young guys, the Hugo Savalas, the Salisi Fekitti, the Blake Steach and the Fahu White. They've made the most of their opportunities in the Roosters jumpers this year. And I think a lot of their good fortunes have come off the back of those guys as well. And you take a look at the Cowboys, especially after last weekend's efforts against the Dolphins, they're just going to need to front up and get a job done. On their day, they're definitely a top eight side. They might not be a premiership threat, but they're good enough on paper to be in the top eight. But if they're going to play anything like they did against the Dolphins last weekend, it's going to be a tough mission for them. So if they play anything like they did against the Dolphins last week, I'm not expecting Todd Payton to be around that job for much longer. And I'm expecting the Roosters to get the job done at home. And then the last matchup of the weekend, the battle for the Spoon, Parramatta Eels taking on the Gold Coast Titans. To be fair, look, I really like the look of the Gold Coast Titans side, and with Kieran Foran in that six jersey partnering with Jaden Campbell, you can't buy that kind of experience. And he's doing a whole lot of good for that Gold Coast side, kind of being the elder statesman, similar to a Daly Cherry Evans role, obviously not with the current success that Manly are having at the moment. And then you take a look at the Parramatta Eels, who, whilst their record obviously isn't showing great signs at the moment, they're just steadily improving week on week, and I think that's all Jason Riles is kind of expecting to get out of them at the moment, is that they just need to improve across the last 11 rounds, and if they can do that well enough, then I think they're holding themselves in good stead for the future. Joish Papali'i gets a first crack in the number 6 jersey, and obviously with Dylan Brown leaving post 2025 season, then it could certainly be a look to the future as well with Papali'i in that 6. He doesn't get to partner Mitch Moses tonight. Obviously, he's still out for another month or so, at least with his injury picked up in Origin. But I'm still expecting to see massive things from Papali'i tonight with his first start in that 5-8 role. So going to be an interesting matchup to finish off the weekend. And I'm thinking that the Parramatta Eels, especially at home as well, will get the job done and finish the weekend on the high.
Sounds good, Joey. Hey, we've had a few technical things which have changed. Thanks, Michelle, our wonderful tech, who's just luckily she was in here on Saturday, or else we could have been in the shock. Anyway, we've got to move very quickly because I've got another guest waiting online. Tiaratu versus Fox, Tiaratu versus Bay Roskill, Ponsonby versus Richmond, and Mount Albert versus Otahu in the top of the table. Tiaratu, Bay Roskill, a very close one to call. I'm actually going to go for Bay Roskill on this one.
Yeah, so am I, to be honest. It's going to be an interesting clash on our live stream this afternoon. Tiaratu are showing good glimpses, but I think Bay Roskill, just being quite consistent, I think they'll be able to get it.
And then we move on to Ponsonby, Richmond, a bit of a local derby, but I think Richmond may be just that little bit too strong for the ponies.
Yeah, I'm probably on the same boat as you as well. Although I'm thinking if Ponsonby are going to get themselves up for any game, it's going to be the game against their neighbours. So I'm thinking it's going to be close, but I still think Richmond will get the 2 points.
Okay, then we move on. Top of the table, Mount Albert versus Otahuhu. I'm going to be straight.
Easily
the game of the round, but I still think probably the easiest game to pick.
Yeah, and I'm thinking along the same lines as you as well. I'm thinking Otahu's forward pack is just going to be too strong this afternoon. You look at the likes of the names they've got on paper. Sebastian Ikehifo seems to be, one of the players of the comp across the first 10 weeks. So I'm thinking he's going to be too good this afternoon. Otahu for the 2 points.
Awesome. Anyway, we move on to Marist Saints versus Papakura, Manukau versus Point Shev. Manukau, Point Shev, I'm going to go Point Shev. I just think they're still going to be in that top four. Marist Saints versus Papakura, I think Papakura really could be the one that could be challenging Otahuhu.
Yeah, and I think I'm going to have to agree with you on that one. Papakura just seems to be a class above a few teams at the moment, and I think that's going to be the case again this afternoon against Marist. But Manukau taking on Point Shev as well. There's going to be another intriguing game. Point Shev, a very young side, like we've said over a number of weeks. I mean, Manukau at home always seems to be a bit of a challenge. They upset Richmond a few weeks ago, and I think there's hints that they might be able to do the same this afternoon, but I think Point Shev will just be able to scrape home.
Absolutely. Well, we'll just call it here. Thanks for just doing part of the show for me while I was having to sort out the headphone problems. It looks like I'm going to go to PB Tech and buy my own one. It's going to feel like Mike Hoskins. But without the talented broadcasting vote and without the money, you have a great weekend and go the Warriors.
And thanks please, for having me again, mate. And hopefully the rain doesn't pack in this afternoon. It looks to be a cracker day at the moment.
Well, I'll be in Christchurch, so we'll catch you later, mate. Cheers. Okay, that was Joey Green from Auckland Rugby League. Next up, we're going to talk to former All Blacks coach Laurie Mains.
World Cup anthem. World in union. There's a dream.
Welcome everyone back to the Sports Weekend. Well, World in Union 1995. It's hard to believe this Tuesday coming up 30 years ago was the World Cup final. We all knew where we were in New Zealand, but here to join us about the All Blacks and probably the best team in a Rugby World Cup, never to win it. And the coach of that side was Laurie Mains, who's also a former All Black, started coaching the All Blacks in 1992. Good morning, Laurie, and welcome to the show.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for having me on.
No problem at all. Well, we look back, it just seems so long ago, 30 years ago, but when we look back heading into this World Cup, Laurie, obviously, you know, you'd probably had your ups and downs, and with results, you had inherited probably an ageing side, and you had to slowly move some out and bring some in, but just this formation of this of the squad, when you played that game in Sydney in 1994, and probably one of the best second halves I've ever seen, you knew after that, once you were appointed to take this team to the World Cup, you knew what you wanted, didn't you?
Well, I did know well before that. That particular game you talk about, I was just surprised at lack of execution of the game plan in the first half. And I think the players were a bit nervous, a bit uptight, and frightened to make mistakes. And at halftime, we just talked about it, and I was certainly backed up by Fitzy. And I just said, look, play the game that we've been talking about. Play the game that we've been practicing. And that resulted in, you know, a very, very good second half.
And, you know, if it wasn't for a, you know, that Gregan tackle on Jeff Wilson, maybe it would have been a different result. But, you know, during this thing, you used a few players, and one of them you did use was Jonah Lomu. Now, you first heard about Jonah Lomu as a schoolboy sensation out of Wesley College, a number eight, but you convinced to change him into a winger. Why was that?
Okay, well, the main reasons were there was two things. There was his physique and his physical capabilities. He was incredibly fast and, you know, it could sidestep as well as any back. But the main reason we said that, you know, he won't be as sensational as a loose forward was because he would be up against men very close to the same size as him. You know, the Tim Gavins, the Willie Offengawe's, the Rodbers of this world, the English eight. And we said if we could turn him into a wing, you know, we would have something that, you know, would be sensational, that it'd be incredibly hard for the wings around the world to tackle. And that was how it turned out. We had to put a lot of work into him. I mean, 94 was a pretty difficult year, both for Jonah and for us. And I enlisted the help of Gordon Titchens at the start of 95 to get Jonah hard fit and allowed him to take him into the seventh squad. And he was sensational in that also. And that, I think, too, was a turning point for Jonah mentally. It took us a while to convince Jonah that we hadn't dropped him from the All Blacks. We simply wanted him to get fit playing rugby. You know, he wasn't great at just doing training. He was great at training if there was a rugby ball involved. So that was the whole aim of letting Gordon take him away in the sevens.
And, of course, when you look back, and it probably was, you know, that decision ended up to make Jonah Lomu probably a sensation in world rugby. But there are also some other decisions. Obviously, you brought in a bit of a personality from Canterbury called Andrew Mertens, but one decision which you, when you did make it, it was considered controversial at the time, but, you know, people like me could see it. You picked Josh Cronfeld and you didn't select Michael Jones due to the fact that the quarterfinals and the semifinals were all going to be, could have been played on a Sunday. Michael Jones, due to his religious convictions, doesn't play rugby on Sunday. Were you, you know, was there any doubts when you made that decision?
Well, of course there was. And I spoke with Michael and asked him if there's any way his church or he or his mother, who was quite influential in that area, if it could be an exception made and him be allowed to play those two Sunday games. And, you know, a couple of weeks later, he did advise me that, no, he you know, his religion came first and he had to stick to it. Mm. And I think at that point in time, it gave us, you know, very little choice. And Michael was very accepting of that.
Mm. And, you know,
he also wanted what was best for the All Blacks.
Which, you know, which Michael Jones is true team player. And, you know, these are the people's convictions and you have to respect them, and good on you, Laurie. Obviously, Zinny Brook, he had snapped an Achilles before that World Cup, but he was really important to that squad, wasn't he, to have him there?
Well, there was quite a number of senior players that were left that had come through from the previous World Cup. They were all incredibly important to the team because they had the experience and knowledge of how the World Cup is, but they were the glue that held the team together. And when you think of a lot of the younger players we brought in, they were able to really expose their abilities and play well because of the support from those experienced players.
And I think it was just that general mix. We look at the tournament, obviously you probably didn't go in as favourites, but, you know, we looked at the, you bet Ireland and Wales, Jonah Lomu was to come to the fore. A big 145 points to 17 fraction of Japan. Mark Ellis was to score 6 tries. And this, these were the days, people, where you could only take 26 players, so you had to have a lot of utilities. Scotland 48-30, and then that match against England, obviously a lot of the older players had their, you know, a bit of revenge for what happened at Twickenham in 1993.
Yeah, there was a bit of that, but we I think it was more not so much looking at revenge, but with the knowledge that England could pull one out of the bag occasionally, and we were going to have to play really well to beat them. And of course, they helped us in the motivation with the team talks. You know, talking up, you know, one his opposition, I forget his name now, said about Jonah. Who's Jonah Lomu? You know, what's he done? Well, that wound Jonah up like a spring, and most of the team as well. They didn't. I think England considered they'd be able to choke us out of that game. They wouldn't let us play the style of rugby we'd played through the World Cup, and they were pretty confident. But all of the work we had done in preparation, England, that 93 game against England was a key factor in me saying, right, we're not big gorillas like those guys. We're not going to be able to play that sort of rugby, take them on, you know, in all this grappling and mauling and so on and so forth. We've got to play a much faster game and get those big guys out of it. And that was the turning point for Earl and I, and we discussed, we spent a lot of time working out how, under the current rules, we'd be able to speed the game up a bit more, particularly at second phase, and move them around so they couldn't grind us into the ground. And that was the start in international rugby of the pick and go. We decided, and Australia was partly the cause of this. They were very, very strong at leaving a couple of loose forwards off the side to look after our inside backs. As I mentioned before, there was Simon Poitevin, there was Offen Garway, there was Tim Gavin, and there was just never any room for our backs to get moving. So we bought in and we spent hours and hours training the way we hit into rucks, how we presented the ball, how we cleaned out the opposition to leave a gap for us to pick it up and go straight through the middle. In 94, I think the first... It played Australia at Carrickbrook, I think it was 94. First time we'd used it in a test match, and 2 tries resulted from it, and we opened them up, and we made them come back into the game, and we had a very good game and a strong win at Carisbrook, and we were on our way. But did we carry on doing that? No, we didn't. We put that in the back pocket and said, right, that's not coming out again till 95. And the players wanted to keep doing it because they enjoyed it so much. But we knew that it was very important to keep tactics like that. Major changes in the game was to keep them quiet.
Okay.
So what we planned to do was have 2 or 3 3-day coaching weekends, training weekend camps, before we took off to the World Cup, and brought all these things together and used them in a couple of friendlies we had.
So obviously we got over England, of course, the final. And, you know, that was probably the biggest game of rugby, the last amateur World Cup. Now, there's been so much said about this finals. There's been movies made. Nobody, I don't know who played you in the movie, Laurie, but there was mentions about Jonah. But you looked at the players were not match fit for this, were they?
How do you mean?
Well, basically...
Well, we were incredibly fit going into that World Cup. I doubt that there would have been... prior to that, I doubt there would have been a fitter side. But on the day, it was, I guess, the biggest knock I've ever had in my life was... As was tradition, the management went out for dinner on Thursday night. We and left the players, you know, to be by themselves. We came back into the hotel, and Zinzo and Brooke, pale as anything, standing in reception, waiting for us to come. And he looked at us as we were coming in, walked straight to me. My heart dropped at that stage, because I knew something serious was wrong just by looking at Zinny. And he came and told us that half of the team were in the docks room, that everybody was vomiting and so on and so forth. And both Colin Meads and Brian Lahore said, you know, it's funny, we don't feel too good either. And, by Friday morning, it was affecting everybody except two players. And I think... that was Fitzy and Josh Krumfeld, who, if I remember correctly, came to the lunch on Thursday a little bit late because I think they might have had press commitments. And as it turned out, you know, I had a private detective. I employed this guy myself because I couldn't get the New Zealand Union to do anything. And... He came back, and one of the things he told us was that it was put into the boys' tea and coffee at that lunch.
So yeah, and it did affect that final. But when you look back at it and you put it, and you must have some sympathy, you know, when you know there was sympathy that went out for those players. That All Black side was the start of a very good All Black era. But, you know, despite all that happens, poor old Mertz, pressure. Mertz, 9 times out of 10, wouldn't have missed that drop goal. But when you looked at it, just from your point of view, you must have been proud of what those guys, especially for what they came through that week to nearly win that World Cup.
Well, on the Friday, we couldn't do a light. What we normally did was a captain's run. We couldn't do that. We did go to the ground, and we walked around the ground talking about, you know, what we would do from this, a scrum here or a line out there or whatever. But the players couldn't really concentrate, and some of them were walking off to the side of the ground to vomit and things like that. It was devastating. I was incredibly proud of the players, the way they, the courage they showed during that final to actually be in a position to have it won. You know, at full time it was 9-all and Mertz had just missed that drop goal. I think what the players achieved that day was remarkable. And to see... I mean, I clearly remember seeing Craig Dowd, Jeff Wilson off on the sideline of that game vomiting, and it was heartbreaking to see it and to know what those players were going through.
Laurie, you know, you probably will have sympathy for Ian Foster. You've been there, you came so close, and you built a really good All Black squad, and I think you should also take pride in what you and Earl Curtin done and the management team. Laurie, I want to thank you so much for making yourself available today, and I want to wish you a good weekend.
Thank you very much. Okay,
my pleasure.
Nice to talk.
Cheers, thanks. That was Laurie Mains. What a fantastic story. And, you know, that 1995 side was one hell of a side. Anyway, next up we'll have Seamus Martin. In fact, we'll go to Seamus right now on line 2. Good morning, Mr. Martin. Sorry for a bit of lateness here.
No, no worries. I could listen to Laurie Maines all morning.
Oh, it's
I thought you might butt me just to get the rest of that story out because it was riveting stuff.
You wouldn't be that lucky. Anyway, we'll get into it now. Big shout out to Robert Thompson from Barford and Thompson looking to buy, sell, or looking to get on that market. Give Robert a call. His number is 021-737-949, or you can email him r.thompson with a P at barfers.co.nz. And Robert, you know, a very, very good real estate agent. He's a real estate agent that cares. Anyway, we better move on. And of course, the Club World Cup, and I hate mentioning this because we always wanted to see a bit of a, how would we say, we wanted to see a Cinderella story, but it's Auckland City FC went down to Benfica 6-0. And to be honest with you, Seamus, you do see the gaps between amateur and professional. It's a huge gulf.
Oh, look, the Cinderella story would be lovely, but the harsh reality of the global game is that, you know, Auckland City are just not able to compete against these professional clubs. This morning's effort, you know, valiant for 45+8 minutes, I think it was, when they conceded the penalty. Poor old Gerson Lagos, the former Melbourne United player, to concede that penalty, which Angel Di Maria tucked away. And the sheer fact that I'm saying Gerson Lagos and Angel Di Maria in the same sentence should speak volumes to just what this really is. You know, Gerson Lagos is a Colombian refugee that ended up here in Hamilton. Now he's on the world stage 6 years later playing against some people that he probably idolises. You know, it is a phenomenal story when you take the scorelines away that these guys are able to do that. And today's game, you know, they did compete for 45 minutes, but you can't play a football match jogging side to side, dropping in deep. The amount of effort that takes on your fitness, and you could see in the second half, Auckland City just ran out of puff. And, you know, you only need to switch off your concentration for brief moments. You blink your eye and you've conceded 5 goals in 45 minutes. And that's the difference that we have. You know, Park's Bayern Munich result 10-0. Let's put that to one side. They've improved against Benfica. They've got the threat of Boca Juniors, the Argentine powerhouses, on Wednesday. If they can improve again, it just goes to show what is possible if you're playing at a consistently high level for these individuals. Let's not suggest this team, but for these individuals. And there'll be some reputations which are enhanced by this performance on the world stage from Auckland City.
Absolutely, and I think we have to put it in reality. Hopefully it's a better result. Hopefully they can get a goal against Boca Juniors. That'd be good. We move on, Seamus, because we've got a lot to get through. The Northern League, and I'm going to run through the games here, and we'll just do Auckland FC Reserves versus Auckland United, Auckland versus Auckland, Bay Olympic versus Mangarewa, Eastern Suburbs versus Tauranga City, Birkenhead United versus West Coast Rangers, and Fencibles versus East Coast Bay. So we start off with that first one. You know, that should be an interesting one because I have seen improvement with Auckland FC Reserves, but Auckland United really do need to get this win to secure themselves in this top four.
Yeah, Auckland United haven't really fired like we might have expected them to this season. And I think actually this is right for the taking for Auckland FC Reserves. I'm going to tip the youngsters in the blue and black to, let's say, upset Auckland United in that game. I think, you know, Auckland United are still in the cup. They come up against the mighty Melville in the round of 16. But I think Auckland FC Reserves might sneak a result here and put a little bit of pressure on Auckland United to make that top four.
And then we move on, Bay Olympic versus Mangarewa. Well, you probably would say Bay Olympic all the way at home.
Yeah, I'd agree with you. Bay Olympic to win over Mangarewa, who bottom of the table, tipped out of the cup by my side, Melville, last weekend. So I think Bay Olympic win that game quite comfortably against Mangarewa, who are really fighting against relegation at the moment.
Eastern Suburbs versus Tauranga City. Tauranga really a threat at home, but I feel that Eastern Suburbs will just be too good.
Well, this is the second time these two teams have played in 2 weeks. They met in the cup last weekend. It was Eastern Suburbs on that occasion winning 5-2 at home. It's once again at Medills Farm. Eastern Suburbs in fifth, Tauranga up in fourth. They're both sort of 1 point behind each other, but I'm going to tip form and I'm going to go Eastern Suburbs just for the sheer fact of last week. They accounted for the same team quite comfortably in the Chatham Cup.
Absolutely, and of course, Birkenhead versus West Coast Rangers, I think it's pretty much certain there. Fencibles versus ECB, interesting match because Fencibles really want to make sure they're clear of that relegation zone, but East Coast Bay still an outside shot at the top four.
Yeah, these two teams, Fencibles and East Coast Bay, is interesting. Ninth plays seventh. Fencibles, I think, might just shade this one at home on the turf against East Coast Bay, but that should be a cracker. That Birkenhead-West Coast Rangers game, on paper, it'll go the way of Birkenhead, but they also met in the Chatham Cup last weekend and needed penalties to separate the two sides, so maybe a little bit closer than you expect, but I think Birkenhead sitting in first place should cement first place by the end of this weekend as well.
Absolutely, and then we move on to the women's premier, Northern League women's premier, East Coast versus Fencibles, Hibiscus Coast versus West Coast Rangers, FC Tauranga Moana versus Auckland United, and Ellerslie versus Western Springs.
Well, the one that jumps out to me there is Eastern Suburbs versus Fencibles, fourth place, fifth. I think Suburbs will be too strong in that one. Auckland United got their noses ahead of West Coast Rangers in the midweek match a couple of weeks ago, so they've got a three-point lead at the top. It's Auckland United who take on Tauranga Moana down in the Bay of Plenty. Auckland United will be too strong in that game and continue winning. Hibiscus Coast up against West Coast. Well, it's the top two this weekend against the bottom two. Hibiscus Coast now in last place. They've been leapfrogged by Tauranga Moana, but West Coast will be too strong for them. And the last game of the weekend, Ellerslie versus Western Springs. That's another tight one. Ellerslie still in the conversation for National League places in the top four, but I think Western Springs under Katie Duncan, their new coach, will be too strong and they should win that game.
Yeah, absolutely. Then we move on to Kiwi, to New Zealand football players that have transferred. Obviously, Costa Barbaroussis, no big surprise. He has moved to Western Sydney Wanderers. James McGarry has gone back to the A-League, leaving Aberdeen to join Brisbane Roar. Is that a surprise for you, Seamus?
No, I think in a World Cup year, and I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, I feel like these players that are on the fringes, McGarry hasn't been in an all-white squad for a little while. I think the sheer fact of just being under the nose of Darren Baisley, playing in the A-League, a little bit of regional bias maybe, just has an opportunity to get in front of the All Whites coach a bit regularly. His time in Scotland wasn't fantastic. He actually ended up out on loan in Greece, and I just think those sort of outlier, you know, competitions, while we've got all the technology in the world and Darren and his technical staff behind the scenes are able to pull the matches down every weekend and research and analyse, just the sheer fact of being here and having the opportunity to be seen in the flesh against Auckland FC playing for Brisbane Roar, I think McGarry's, it's a good move for McGarry. Costa to Western Sydney Wanderers doesn't surprise me. I think he's kind of been close to one of the most disliked players in the A-League despite his result, because his former fans at Sydney FC are going to be booing him. Already it's the fans at Melbourne Victory were booing him, and maybe, just maybe, we might see a few of the Wellington Phoenix fans booing Costa Barbaroussis again when they take on Western Sydney later on this year. But he's another one that will want to get minutes in the tank this year. So, you know, interesting move for those two. The other one which caught my attention is Big George Stanger, the young centre-back, signing with Kilmarnock in the Scottish Premier League from Ayr United. That's a huge move for him. That's a really positive one, and that, I think, is another signal of intent to say, I want to play at the highest level possible to force myself into the conversation for this all-white squad. I mentioned him as a possibility, or someone that a team like the Wellington Phoenix might want to chase to get a Kiwi closer to home. Interestingly, Phoenix have made three signings on the women's side, no signings yet on the men's side. So I think Yellow Fever fans will be starting to get a little bit itchy, wondering if there's going to be any movement for Chiefy and the team in black and yellow. And the other one which caught my attention is Millwall seem to be closing in on Max Crocombe.
I sent you that last night. It seems it's just about a done deal. So that's a huge move for Max Crocombe, who, to me, that's a wonderful story. This was a guy about 3 or 4 years ago was playing non-league football.
Yeah, look, it just goes to show if you're hanging around in and about those competitions, eventually your class will show. You know, Millwall's a big club. They haven't been to the very, very top of English football for a long time, but they've got a long history and a big pedigree. And I dare say this is Crocombe off the back of some positive performances in Canada with the national team, which forces him into these conversation. So, look, again, if we loop right back to the beginning of the conversation with Auckland City at the Club World Cup, I've been really impressed with this competition. I was probably one of these people that thought maybe we didn't necessarily need it. I'm sitting here on a Saturday morning tuning into LAFC versus Esperance de Tunisia. I never thought I'd see these two teams playing one another, but it's fascinating to see, you know, these two styles and this competition on the world stage. So, look, a wonderful time for football. I feel like I keep saying it. I feel like I'm a broken record, but you know, having Kiwis on the world stage and having, you know, having conversations like this about where they're going and what they might doing is phenomenal for the sport.
And also some other rumours, obviously Libby Kadachi, Calagri and Pisa are now making a move. Also, Nice have shown interest, and as is Anderlecht in Belgium. And of course, Eli Just, another one from that great under 20 side, which you were involved with, for Des Buckingham. Splenzia and Syria B have shown interest in Eli.
Yeah, I think for Darren Baisley, the Libby Kakachi move is probably the one that he will have most interest in, because, you know, Libby is a shoo-in for the All Whites, isn't he? He wears the captain's armband in the absence of Chris Wood. He's one of our top players. So the sooner his future can be nailed down, I think the more comfortable Darren Baisley will be, because he needs to be playing at the highest level possible. In a similar vein, Eli Just is too good for the competition that he's playing in. Showed his class in that match against Cote d'Ivoire with a really well-taken goal. If he can get a move somewhere at a slightly higher level, that just is going to really help the All Whites in the lead-up to that World Cup next year. The other one, which there isn't a lot of talk around him or about him, that needs to find a home very quickly, is Matthew Garbutt.
Yeah.
Garbutt hasn't played, you know, club football in around 8 months. You know, he's been selected in the national team. Maybe Darren taking a little bit of a chance on a player he knows a lot about, and selecting on reputation rather than on form. But Matthew Garbutt needs to find a home very, very quickly. And it might even be a case of taking a step back, taking a step down following, you know, a James McGarry, and getting an opportunity to play week in, week out in the A-League. He's too good to be playing in the A-League, don't get me wrong, but the longer he goes without a home, the more I think he'll be looking over his shoulder, because as we've seen with these all-white squads, there's some very good players that are on the fringes and would step up to that level and that squad in a heartbeat.
Absolutely. Well, Seamus, thanks for making your time available to me. Sorry it was a bit quicker than usual, but it's just been one of the things. Obviously, Chiefs versus Crusaders, I know which way you're heading, but I'll be down for my mum's birthday, which was yesterday, but I'm heading down on the Big Bird this afternoon. So,
excellent. Look, that'll be stepping out of football, round ball football for a minute, into the oval ball. What a phenomenal occasion that'll be down in Christchurch, the last game there before they move to that new stadium.
Project Stadium, as far as I'm concerned.
I think it's going to be an unhappy night for the Crusaders fans. There you go, spoken like a two-cheat Chiefs man.
Mate, there'll be no Cowboy Hills there. Anyway, you take care. Cheers, Seamus. Bye.
Thanks, mate. Bye-bye.
That was Seamus Martin. Anyway, I'm just going to play a little bit of quick music, and then I'm going to do a pre-record what I done yesterday with Gordon Bray.
Someone to tell you everything. Sit around and wonder what tomorrow will bring. Maybe a dabble in.
Well, it's alright, even if they say you're wrong. Well, it's alright. Sometimes you got.
Welcome everyone back to the Sports Weekender. I done a pre-record yesterday with Gordon Bray, so hopefully it comes through well.
Welcome everyone back to the Sports Weekender. I hope you've enjoyed the show. Well, we're doing a special recording here, and he'd have joined us, as he does, but...
this stage, although the hot off the press news is that Marnus Labuschagne has been dropped for the first test match against the West Indies. He's really been struggling, I've got to say. I think he's averaged about 28 in the last 12 months, and a double failure, really, 17 and 22 at Lord's. But just before we delve into the age of the Australian team and the future, I've got to give great credit to South Africa, because they really came back from Death Valley, didn't they? The Australian tail wagged in that second innings. They put on 59 for the last wicket. So you would thought 282 runs to win, you'd put all your money on the Aussies. But I think the pitch also was settling, getting better as the match progressed. And that innings by Markram, 136 from just 207 balls, I think rates as one of the great test match innings, given the context of the match.
Certainly does.
He reminded me, he took me back to many years ago, some of those great South African batsmen who played with that assurance and that confidence and that class and technique, people like Pollock, Barlow, Goddard, Bland. It was that sort of confidence that really shone through. So that was a marvellous innings by Markram. And what about the ageing new ball bowler, Pavuma, Rambada, 5 for 51 and 4 for 59. Pavuma, of course, the captain with his 66. That was a great captain's hand in the second innings. But Rambada taking 9 wickets was also a huge effort. Getting back to your question, I think, you've got to say Khawaja. I'm surprised that he hasn't met with the axe, but they're sticking with experience, I suppose. At 38, that's a double failure for him in that game. A duck and 6. Cameron Green, the newcomer into the side after a long layoff, he had a double failure. Travis Head, who's come to our rescue, he also 11 and 9. Really only Steve Smith in the first innings, and also newcomer Webster with 72. Otherwise, the Australian top order batting has been pretty well a disaster in that World Championship match. So I'd be pointing the finger more at the batsmen rather than the bowlers. But yeah, you look at their ages, it is a concern, and there has to be a transition, you would think, in the next couple of years. But look at Hazelwood, look at Stark, Cummings, they're all still superbly fit athletes, but that pitch really settled down in the second innings, which made life very difficult for the Australian attack.
Absolutely, and of course, some of the of course, a couple of big series coming up at the end of the year with the Ashes happening, and I think it's going to be a tough call for Australia on whatever happens to this to that bowling attack, because I think a lot of them will probably get their swan song at the Ashes, Gordon, by the looks of it.
Yeah, well, look, they're playing so much cricket now, aren't they? There's so much money on offer, and these guys, you've got to look after them. They try to look after themselves, but I've got to say, I was very impressed with the stamina of the Australian attack. But I think going into a one-off test like this, they were a little underdone, and that really came home to roost.
Absolutely. Okay, so we move on. Of course, State of Origin, wow, I have to say, when you look back at it, Cameron Munster, what a superb match. Great game by Kurt Capewell of the New Zealand Warriors. And really, the Empire struck back on this one, because a lot of people were writing off Queensland, and of course, during the week, some controversy with a statement from Billy Slater, which Aaron Woods, former New South Wales prop, Aaron Woods, basically called him a grub. So, that State of Origin is going to go down to a third, and every time it goes down to a third match, I tend to favour Queensland in it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think you could be right, but I think the Blues will start favourite for the last game. I mean, you score 5 tries and still lose the game. What's going on? They just gave away through their own indiscipline, I think, their mistakes in that first half. To trail by 20 points at halftime, it's a long way back for the Blues. And also the wet weather played a big part, I think. But discipline, 8-0 the penalty count in that first half. And you've got Nathan Cleary with a groin injury. So, yeah, there was a lot not happening for the Blues, but yeah, I'll probably go against you there. I think they'll take it out in the third game.
Yeah, I think they basically, it was a terrible first half, and it could have ended up it could have ended up going to New South Wales. But hey, this is the great thing about State of Origin. It does bring in all these great matches. Just looking at the week that was, and of course, Joe Smith has named his Wallaby side, and you know, no place for the departing James O'Connor from the Crusaders, but he's put in Tane Edmund, has made the side, so they've made a number of big changes.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Look, James O'Connor, I think, was always going to be pushing it. I think if there were injuries with the number 10s, you've got Lola Sio. He's probably the front runner for the test against Fiji, that match being played on July 6th in Newcastle. You've got Tom Liner, and also you've got Donaldson. So Joe Schmidt was queried about that, and he said, look, we've invested in these young guys, and we're going to stick with them. Apparently, he did also speak to Bernard Foley, who's in Japan. Mm. One surprise omission I thought he might have been included was Samu Karebi, who's been in very good form in Japan, but he didn't make the grade. And a couple of other surprise omissions, perhaps Lucan Solikai-Loto and Seru Uro. I thought those two would have been in the 36-man squad. But congratulations. You know, there was a couple of new caps coming into the side. Nick Champion de Krepney, and also winger Corey Toole, who scored those two brilliant individual tries, didn't he, against the Chiefs last weekend. A real speedster. Mm. There's not much of him, but he reminds me a bit of Corey Jane. And he's got a lot of skill, a lot of pace, and that is a big factor. But I think Kellaway's ahead of him at test level.
Absolutely. Well, when you have a look at this Australian side, it's a really well-balanced side. You have a look at it. Obviously, Will Skelton's in the side. Valentino, you know, this loose forward trio that's there is a very, very good loose forward trio. And, of course, tomorrow morning, the Lions will be playing the Los Pumas in Dublin.
Yeah, that's going to be very interesting. It's mainly an English combination for the Lions, English heavy combination, so at least they will have those combinations. But I'm sure the Pumas will give them a bit of a fright in this game. There's plenty to play for as far as they're concerned. But, yeah, it's the first match for the Lions in Australia will be in Perth, where we've just had the State of Origin, and that'll be against the Force. But Joe Schmidt has pulled out a few of the Force players who are likely to be in the Test 23. So that has weakened the Force team for that match, which is a disappointment, really. But I guess the prime target for Joe Schmidt is the Test series. And all of those Test series, the last three Test series, 89, 2001, 2013, have all gone down to the final Test, Damon. Yeah. So it's,
and just,
I'm hoping and predicting we'll see a decider again in the Sydney Test match in 2025.
Yeah, just getting back to the Lions, like in those three tests, you were the commentator for ABC at the time and Channel 7 at the time. Just some of your memories, Gordon.
Well, 89, Australia, I think, won the first test at the Gabba, and then in the second test, we had a real all-in brawl after a couple of minutes. Robert Jones, the Welsh scrum half, there obviously was a ploy there by the Welsh to upset the Australians early on. Mm. And I think he trod on the foot of Nick Farr-Jones at the scrum feed. Nick retaliated, and then, of course, it was an all-in brawl. And it went on for a good minute or so. And it totally unsettled the Wallabies. So it was a deliberate ploy, I'm quite sure, by the management. And it certainly set things up in 1989. And then, of course, we had the David Campese infamous pass to Greg Martin on his line. And Yeyan Evans couldn't believe his luck. Poor old Campo. He almost said he was going to retire after that mishap. But when you think that 2 years later, at the World Cup in 91, he was player of the tournament. So, as Campo says, you've got to be prepared to fail. And I wouldn't say that pass cost Australia the series. Australia as a team in that third test wasn't quite good enough. And then in 2001, well, I guess it came down to Joe Roth in the second test. Australia was struggling at halftime after losing the first test. And it came down to the second test. Joe Roth got an intercept from a Johnny Wilkinson pass, and then the Australians regained some of their confidence. And remember, at that stage, Australia was the world champion team. And then the third test, Justin Harrison, that line-out steal just a few minutes from full-time against Martin Johnson. And doesn't he dine out on that one? But he's remembered for that one line-out, that one line-out steal, which clinched the series for Australia. Good luck to him. Yeah. And then in 2013, well, it came down to the third test. James O'Connor played number 10 in that game for Robbie Deans. It was Robbie Deans' last test. Mm-hmm. It was 1-1. I just remember Israel Folau in the first test was in sensational form. Mm-hmm. But Curtly Beale could have won the game, but he slipped over when he was attempting what would have been the winning penalty goal.
That was in the second test, wasn't it?
Was that the second test? Yeah.
And, of course, when you think about the great rivalry between the Lions, and whenever a Lions tour comes, like you look back in 1989, and you look back at it, and it was something that hadn't happened in a while. And, of course, now we have Lions tours. Lions tours have become huge business in this professional era.
Well, you've got, I remember, was it 2007 in New Zealand?
Yeah, 2005.
And, yeah, that was, I mean, that was, I was over there then, and I just couldn't believe the wonderful feeling, the atmosphere with all those Lions fans. There were 40,000 of them. And I think in 2001, in that first test match, they were all at the ground in Brisbane, and the Australians couldn't believe it. There were more Lions fans there than Australian supporters. It was quite intimidating.
Yeah,
it really was intimidating. And so, yeah, it's they like to drink. They've been saving up. They've been knocked out by COVID. So, yeah, I think they'll be here in full force, and it'll be a huge boost for the Australian economy.
Oh, it'll be a huge boost to a lot of those major cities in the hospitality industry. Just in closing, Gordon, of course, last week we sadly lost the great Stu Wilson. You and I spoke during the week. You knew Stu quite well, and you actually worked with Stu. He was a comments man for you several times when you were over in New Zealand. Just some of your great memories of Stu Wilson.
Well, I remember as a young boy watching him when we got the live telecast from New Zealand, and the great Keith Quinn was commentating. But before I took over as television commentator with the ABC in 1980, I used to love watching Stu Wilson. I guess lightning pace. He was a very physical winger, very precise skills, but he played with such confidence. And that blonde hair, he was it was unmistakable, wasn't it? I was over with the Classic Wallabies in Bermuda, and we had a reception with Andy Hayden and the Classic All Blacks. So it was just the Classic Wallabies and the Classic All Blacks. And I was standing next to Stu Wilson, and they were cooking on the barbecue. And the guy said, "Now, what can I do for you, sir?" And Stu came out and said, "I'll have one fried koala bear, please, and any bit of steak that Wally Lewis might have eaten."
that was his line, just
out of the blue. And look, I think with Channel 10 and Channel 7, we always used Stu as our New Zealand commentator when we were across the Tasman. So he always joined us because we wanted to make sure we got some balance into our commentary, and he always gave us that. But look, he was a fun-loving guy off the field, a wicked wit, I've got to say.
Yes,
very concise in his reading of the game, and he always had a beer afterwards. He was a ray of sunshine, Eamon, on and off the field, a great All Black rugby man.
Well, many would call him, you know, there's been so many tributes over the past couple of weeks, Gordon, to Stu, and, you know, he was probably, you know, many would say a lovable rogue, sort of. He just had as I said to many people, he was in that exclusive club, but when he met you, his time to you was inclusive. And, you know, sadly we've lost him. So what's up for the weekend for Mr. Bray? And by the way, I'm happy you backed that horse.
Yes, yes, that was a fantastic tip. Thank you very much. Another Kiwi Raider taking the bickies. It happens very often over on this side of the Tasman, I've got to say. But, yes, so I'm in Port Macquarie, and it's the 30th anniversary for the Hastings Valley
Vikings.
You did
say that. You did say that, yeah.
Yeah, we will have a really good time going to watch the first grade game, and they said, would you like to present the jerseys? I said, I'd love to. So, I mean, the country areas are so neglected in the modern era in professional rugby. And, you know, the classic case is Steve Merrick. If we go back to 1995, when he was plucked from Singleton Rugby Club to play for New South Wales against Queensland, and then found himself playing against the All Blacks at Eden Park. And he hadn't even had a training run because he didn't have a mouthguard. And he spent all morning at the dentist getting a mouthguard. And then he basically only had a captain's run at Eden Park and then played a test match against the All Blacks, played the following week back in Australia, and then said, I don't want to be paid to play rugby. I think I've told you this story. Yes. He was offered $400,000. He was also offered $100,000 right now to sign on with the Rebel thing. But he said, look, he said, I'd grow to hate the game if I was played or paid to train. So I'd rather be back at Singleton where I can play out on my front street and a car won't come past for about 20 overs in a game of cricket. And he went on to play another 100 games for Singleton Rugby Club as an amateur. And guess what? He said, Gordon, my older brother was a better player than me. So there's all that talent out there in the country areas, but unfortunately it never sees the day, the light of day.
Anyway, Gordon, we'll wrap it up there. Gordon, enjoy your weekend. We'll catch up in 4 weeks' time where we'll preview the first test between the Wallabies and Lions. Thanks, Gordon.
Welcome everyone back to the Sports Weekend. Well, it's been one hell of a morning, one hell of a last 24 hours for me, but back from the US of A and back to look at the sporting week, the mouth of the South, what the fans want, what the fans need. Lee Piper, good morning.
G'day, how are you?
Good, good, good. Welcome back. Well, big news to start it off, Peter Berlin leaving Team New Zealand, will be joining Luna Ross. And now, I heard Jason Pyne say, is he the first of the dominoes to fall down? Well, I think it's proving that. Knowing the information I've had in the past, previous to the last America's Cup they had, he considered moving to another European America's Cup syndicate. So this is Grant Dalton will be moving heaven and earth to stop him from sailing under that nationality rule. The other thing too is he takes away a lot of vital IP away from Team New Zealand.
Yeah, it's what's interesting in this is where's the Russell Coutts, Brad Butterworth outcry? Yes, you're right, under the nationality rule, what I read, which is potentially what everyone's read, is he's going to try and scoot his way around that. But effectively, it's the same thing. He's jumping ship. He's taking, to your point, the IP that he's obtained with Team New Zealand, and he's selling it, and he is going to Luna Rossa. Interestingly, he was on the plane. He was a lot further up the plane than me on the way to New York in 1A, 1B, and his children were in 1T, but whatever they were. But yes, no, he, not a big man actually when you stand beside him, but obviously a lot of intelligence. It'll be interesting to see the New Zealand public's reaction to this because the Duke Burling phenomenon has been there, hasn't it, really, for the last kind of 10 years. And it's what's captured the America's Cup that we have a New Zealand lead skipper and these two are mates and they are Olympians and they've won everything. And now that's not the way. And I think, again, it will bring into question the value of the America's Cup to New Zealand and where we see it. And unfortunately, what happens when someone like Burling jumps ship, and to your point, there could be others that go, is it just exposes the sport for what it is, which is basically I am prepared to sell myself to the highest bidder for as much money as I can. And he was correct when he said, but I'll still sail GP for New Zealand for the black foils and I'll look forward to the Olympics, etc. So what he's saying is, to me, those are pure country-run events. In other words, you represent your country at the sail GP, you represent the country at the Olympics. The America's Cup's a different kettle of fish. It's every man for himself. And so, you know, I think we've got to take heed of that and say, perhaps our romance with it will gloss. I'm pretty sure it will, particularly again that we're going overseas to compete in it. Yeah, we'll want to win it. But for me, I just raise my eyebrows, and I think a lot of sports fans in New Zealand, you know, here we go again. It won't be as brutal as the Coutts Butterworth coup because that one really stung. We just didn't know enough about it. You know, they'd done such a great job, and it seemed a betrayal to Sir Peter Blake and Tom Schmeckenberg and others, so not sure on this one, but definitely, you know, also questions around Grant Dalton's management of it. How did they really get on? Was there friction? All of those things are going to come.
That's what I was just going to get to.
Going
to
come to light, aren't they?
Yeah, that's what I was just going to get to. You know, I heard what Burling said. He said, "Oh, I've always, you know, we've had a great relationship, and every so and so." It seems to me like, you know, like they mentioned that he left Team New Zealand in, you know, left it well. But to me, I think the relationship between Dalton and Burling, it must have broke down to such a level that he's probably been offered good money to go to Luna Rossa and he said, stuff it, I'm taking it.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I think the thing with it is that I've got no idea where these guys get paid, right? So let's just use a figure and say it's $1 million.
He's slightly above your salary, Piper.
Yeah, so let's just call it an even million, right? Say, for example, Luna Ross has said, right, well, we're going to pay you 1.5 or 2. Are you telling me that Grant Dalton couldn't go to Emirates or couldn't go to a private investor, and that's what the America's Cup, and say, hey, we're going to lose Burling unless we can front worth 1.7, 1.8 or match what Luna Ross are putting on the table. He's the whole game. He's your skipper. He's your brand ambassador. From a sponsorship, he is your connection in. He's well-spoken. He's got a young family. He's everything that you want. Are you telling me you couldn't raise money to keep him? You could. So the point then goes, okay, so what happened? And I think it's pretty obvious to your point that the relationship had come to an end. Maybe Burling wanted to head in another direction. Maybe Dalton didn't. Or the other players that Burling wanted to do something else, get off the boat, maybe look at how he could win with another syndicate. There are a whole lot of things at play. But for me, with a guy with a young family, I would have thought he would have taken the path of least resistance, particularly when you're looking at how I manage that family unit.
Yes, it's interesting. It, as we just said, there's probably going to be more stories to come out with at least one thing about America's Cup. Just when you think it's getting boring, they throw this into it. But I must admit, it's a bit of an old laugh. Super Rugby final, Chiefs versus Crusaders versus Chiefs. Goodbye to Clayton McMillan. Goodbye to James O'Connor. And goodbye to that dump of a scaffolding in Addington.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting, this, isn't it? Because I think it's Canterbury or it's the Crusaders versus the world, isn't it? Because outside of that, I don't think there's too much club life. There's certainly not. I wouldn't say they'd be getting too much South Island support outside of their own region. But, yeah, look, Clayton McMillan's done a phenomenal job with the Chiefs. Many think a guy like him would have been a good player to be in charge of the All Blacks. You never know. Goodbye to James O'Connor. Look, he's been good for them, but rugby nomads come and go. And, you know, obviously goodbye to the stadium at Addington, which is phenomenal, really, isn't it? When you think back to 2011, it's kind of chucked up as a temporary replacement for the foiled Lancaster Park. And now some almost 15 years later, they're about to move into new premises. It's just, I mean, they've actually done pretty well to battle along with what they've got. I've been in that stadium a couple of times. Their corporate facilities, when they're all temporary, and so when it's, you know, when there's a decent crowd there, you feel like you're going to fall through the floor. So, yeah, look, I think it's a good thing. But these covered stadiums are going to, they're a great thing. You know, you come back from the States, and I know they've got a massive population, but their sporting facilities are, you know, they are just phenomenal, really. And, you know, if you use Yankee Stadium as an example, I had actually been to the original Yankee Stadium. They decided it was too old, so they built the new Yankee Stadium next door. And then when they were ready to go, they just basically moved over one day and then just demolished it. So you go to Houston. Houston's a shocking place. Don't go there unless you're going to go to the space station, which is awesome. But the Toyota Center, the NRG Stadium, the Daikin Stadium, it's just huge, huge facilities that are just, you know, out of this world in terms of structures and facilities. So, you know, you do raise your eyebrows because Auckland relative to America is still a reasonably big city. You know, 2 million people odd, that would be a good city in America. And we still can't get our shite together around what we're doing for facilities. And so, you know, good luck to Christchurch. You're going to have a great facility there. And then I'm sure the Crusaders will enjoy that. But for tonight, I think most of us will be Chiefs fans.
Well, you might. I'm going. And, well, I've actually backed the Chiefs to win, but I'm heading into the homeland because it's my mother's 80th birthday. And
it's magnificent.
Yeah, and you know, she's not going to be very happy with you, Lee, bagging Canterbury. She said that Piper bags Canterbury all the time.
I do. Well, I was in Canterbury this week, and it was sat freezing cold on whatever day it was, I think Tuesday. And I ended up having to drive because the airports got closed because it was too cold. And I chucked my big Highlanders jacket in the truck thinking, oh, well, what? And then I ended up walking and I had it on. And the abuse I got in about 150 metres, it's not like the Highlanders are any threat. But, yes, no, look, it'll be an interesting game for sure. But as I say, I think that, you know, there'll be a few Chiefs supporters out there, except for you and your lovely 80-year-old mother, who I'm sure you are the twinkle of her eye.
Thank you very, very much, Lee. Anyway, I must... We go back almost 30 years this Tuesday, 1995, the World Cup final, the Mandela effect. When you look back, the big plane over Ellis Park, Andrew Merton's missing that drop goal. Then we look at the drop goal by Josh Stransky, Invictus. You know, obviously, I did ask Laurie Maines who played him in the movie, but there wasn't a response to that. But anyway, we must. But when we look back, I just had Laurie Maines on earlier. I look back at that 1995 World Cup. I think it was a game changer for Rugby World Cups because the first two had been pretty ordinary, but this was really the World Cup where it came alive. It was the last of the amateur World Cups, and you know that was, you know, I remember where I was, and you probably remember where you were.
I was in Gore. But what I would say was, there's a lot around, I mean, you touch on a good point there about the last point being amateur. I think there's a couple of things played into play here. One, it was the first time that South Africa had been back. They had been back since 1992, and you remember that we toured there basically post-apartheid. But this was the first time they'd really come back. They toured here in 94, and so this was their first Rugby World Cup. And so it was the first time that, you know, they believed and everyone believed that this was a true Rugby World Cup in the full sense. I don't know how deep you got with Laurie, but, you know, he would argue that in 1994 we were playing a pretty boring style. You'll remember this because we went over to Australia, we were down at halftime and we were out of the game. We threw the ball around And then there was the infamous George Gregan tackle onto Jeff Wilson. Their play on this is we always intended to not keep this under our hat, keep this under our hat and take it to Rugby World Cup. And then what happened was the explosion. Well, I would debate that slightly. I think what happened in 1995 was that one bloke wandered onto the scene who changed the game, and that was Lomu. And they didn't have Lomu in 94. In fact, you remember he played the first tests against France as an 18-year-old and then was dropped. He was phenomenal in South Africa, and those conditions suited him. He was a big guy. He was on top of the ground. And sure, we did change the way. But remember, guys like Josh Kronfeld came in, Glenn Osborne came in.
Mertens
came into the fold a bit more than what he had. Remember, he didn't play in 1994. And so all of these guys got thrown out, and this new breed came in. So I think there was a bit of luck involved. But if you're going to write a story, you know, it was South Africa's story, really, wasn't it? You know, post-apartheid, if you point the Mandela theory. Yes, while we didn't win it, I think it was a bit like tonight. You know, I think the rest of the world wanted South Africa too. You know, Laurie would argue about the Susie poison incident. Sure, maybe.
Well, he didn't actually mention name, but he did say, and I've actually spoken to a few ex-All Blacks, and they, you know, they won't name themselves, and they just said, yeah, they were as crook as dogs. Now, whether it was intentional or unintentional, it did happen. Now, you've got to, to prove it was intentional, you have to go a long way, and that's something that can never be proved. But those guys were crook, Lee.
There's no question they were crook. But you could be, you know, a bit like COVID, you could be one's crook and then suddenly 10 are crook within a small group in a confined area. But look, sure, but the theory was, and look, James Small did a great job of shutting down Lomu. We had our opportunities in the game. We didn't take them. To your point, Mertens missed a drop goal. Joel Schrant to get one, and we lost the game, and that was the end of that. But, and then, of course, the flow-on effect for that, which was as interesting, was that there was these secret meetings happening behind doors with the Super League of Rugby, and a lot of players basically signed. And it was only Kronfeld and Wilson, really, that were leading the charge with, you know, with New Zealand rugby. Jock Hobbs was a major contributing factor, and Brian Lahore, and that's how they kind of got them across the line.
Also, you can't forget the work Rob Fisher done. Rob Fisher done a lot of good work there.
Yeah, a lot of good work. And so they were going. I mean, I know a few of those All Blacks, and they were at the end of their careers and not surprisingly wanting to go. And they definitely didn't make as much money in Super Rugby as they were. But, you know, guys like Francois Pienaar were leading the race. You know, there was a lot of All Blacks, particularly older All Blacks, that were very keen to jump. And it was big money, and it was big sign-on money as well, which they missed out on, you know, in the end. And then the introduction of Super Rugby, to your point, in 96. And we just haven't got anywhere near that. I remember going to Carisbrook, and the Highlanders were playing, and Jimmy Barnes came in half pissed on, you know, off the helicopter, swiggling down vodka and doing a rock concert. And this was on a Wednesday afternoon. And there's like 35,000 there. You know, it was great stuff. And we were playing the Sharks or the Bulls or whoever from South Africa who we'd never played in our lives. So it was a magnificent time for rugby. And I don't, you know, I'm not sure that we're better today, you know, some 30 years on. Are we a better rugby nation in terms of the game, the spirit of the game, the development of the game? Would you say 30 years on? He's outside. 30 years on, that the game is better. I would argue the game is worse. You know, the rules are horrendous. No one understands them. There's yellow cards handed out for, you know, for tackles where a guy slightly moves and he gets taken high. You know, I don't think that's, I know safety is paramount, but I don't believe that we've developed the game in 30 years. When you look back, what's happened to club rugby? Well, that's got worse. You know, we're squeezed into more and more windows. The NPC's fallen off the tree to the point that you can't even broadcast it. Fully now. No one turns up to NPC at all. We're looking at having to go out of our major grounds to try and get crowds in so it doesn't look so terrible. Club rugby suffered, to my point. Super rugby really is not what it was back then. We're lucky to draw a crowd of, you know, 10 to 12,000 in most Super Rugby games. We're closing one half of the stadium so the crowd doesn't look as grand. And we've got the New Zealand Rugby Union standing there going, the game's never been in better shape, despite the fact we're losing money hand over fist. 30 years is a long time.
I'll say this right now. Yeah, well, obviously, since you've been away, there's been a few changes happening in there. Hey, just, I was going to, we'll get to it another time, just your experience in America, but I'm going to throw something at, what are you hearing about who's going to replace Mark Robinson? Because I've got a couple of theories on that.
Well, no more than what's been read. I'd be interested to see if it was someone like Sophie Maloney from Sky. That would be an interesting call. Of the names that I read in the Herald, I think they're the only one that have thrown up some potentials. She came across as the leading candidate to me. But again, it's what skill set are they after? Where are they looking to go? I'm not sure. Again, I'm not sure they're going to promote someone like Mainsbridge from within the within the super group. Are they going to go for someone like Greg Forum, ex-CEO of Walmart and Air New Zealand? I wouldn't think so. That's a bit corporate-y. So, it's going to be interesting to see they lean. What's your theory?
I've got a name I'm going to throw out there. Don't be surprised in the next few months if you hear the name Lee Jamon.
Lee Piper. They haven't talked.
No. Well, I might end up getting a job at New Zealand Rugby, you know.
Oh, you get good seats.
Yeah, well, I'll get good seats.
And your mother.
Yeah, come on, mate, enough of that, please. Who is it? But seriously, Jamon, he's building up a good, he's done very well at cricket. He's at New South Wales cricket. Could be a possibility, someone different, has been involved with Tasman Rugby in the past, so does have that rugby IP.
Yeah, I think that's, I would put that in the bolter category. I think they're going to be after someone, it also depends on the makeup of the board and what the board skill set are relative to the CEO and what they need at this time, right? So sometimes you get CEOs that the game's in great heart, it's humming along excellent, and you're going, right, well, we just need more of that, and they get more of that. Or you go, actually, we need a complete change and we need to pivot, so what do we need for right now? So what do we need in the next 2 or 3 years? And that's why I quite like the Sophie Maloney play, because I think broadcast deals and content and our ability to commercialise that and where that's heading is playing such an important role, the development of NZR Plus, all of that kind of stuff. I can see how that she might come into play there. And if you've got that experience on the board with the David Kirks now and a few others, they might suddenly think, we don't need specifically a rugby bloke, which is what they had in Mark Robinson and to a lesser degree, Steve Chu.
I'll be honest with you. Sophie Maloney's interesting. I'll be straight to the point. I've got my doubts on Sophie Maloney. She hasn't really crowned herself in glory at Sky TV, Lee.
Yeah, but those are tough jobs. It's like Jodie Jodie O'Donnell at TVNZ. Greg Foran, even Cameron George at the Warriors. They're tough gigs and they're public gigs, and so you never win on those gigs because you're going to get hammered by someone somewhere. And I think Cameron George has done a pretty good job at the Warriors.
I think he has actually. Yeah.
You could argue there'd be a good case to say there's a guy that's taken a fan base and created them into fanatics, no matter whether they win, lose, or draw. Massive sponsorship deals, good broadcast on TV, massive sellout crowds. Big corporates, developing the game, looking at other franchises and opportunities. What more could a guy do? But those big corporate gigs, the Skies, the TVNZs, the Air New Zealands, those very public ones, it's very hard to come across as a 100% play. So, but again, I think it goes back to the skill set. We've got a new NZRU board in there, so time will tell, I guess.
Absolutely. Well, what was it I was going to say? We'll call it there, Lee. Have a good weekend, and we'll catch up soon. And when are you in Auckland next?
A couple of weeks.
Okay, I've got no doubt that I will have to put my hand in my pocket and buy you a
first.
Well, no. Come on. You know it's not a first. Anyway, have a good weekend. Cheers, Lee.
All right. Cheers, mate.
Cheers. Okay, thanks, everyone. It's been an interesting old couple of 24 hours, so I'll catch you all next week.